I don't know much of anything about fishing. And I certainly don't know about the kind of fishing that Simon and James and John were doing on Lake Gennesaret. Nothing really at all. So thankfully, there are scholars who do know about fishing in this region at this time. And they will tell you that the fact that Simon and the others are partners, as it says in the text, means that they're more than likely operating under a contract, working together for the occupying Roman government. And the contract would have had set prices and quotas and schedules to abide by. And more than likely, that contract would not have been met if we listen to what Simon tells Jesus about the unsuccessful night that they had had fishing before. But despite all that, the point is, these are professional fishermen. These are experts. They know these waters, the deep waters of the lake, and they know how to navigate them. When Jesus shows up, they're in the middle of another important task. They're cleaning the nets. This is vital to making sure that the nets stay intact and that they are able to go out another day. Maybe Jesus senses the mood, the exhaustion, the disappointment, maybe even anxiety and fear that the contract may be lost. Certainly, income has been lost. Then, after he's finished teaching, he tells Simon to put out again for the deep water. Now, Simon knows Jesus because only a couple of days before, in fact, Jesus had been in Simon's house and he healed Simon's mother from a fever so completely that she popped right up and started serving people on the spot. So when Jesus asks him to teach from his boat, I'm sure Simon was happy to oblige. But when Jesus wants him to try again with the fishing, Simon starts to resist. This is Simon's territory. Master, he says. Actually, in the Greek, it's probably closer to supervisor or probably more something like boss. Boss, okay, but we were just out in those waters all night and there are no fish out there. But okay, if you say so. Clearly, Simon never expected what would happen next. So many fish that he had to call in the reinforcements, a catch beyond his imagining. Now, I'm guessing you've heard this story before. If you've been in church at this time of year, it tends to come up from one of the gospels or the other. And some of you may even know the Sunday school song that I learned, in which Jesus says, "I will make you fishers of men." The way I learned about this story is that it's a simple story about evangelism, catching people for Jesus, reeling them in and bringing them into the church by the boatload. It's such a well-known interpretation of this text that when I saw that this was the text for today, I said, "Really, God? We are going to take this familiar text on this day? What could possibly go wrong?" Yet, if you say so. As Lindsay said, I've had the pleasure of meeting some of you over the past few days, and I want to say it's really, really been a pleasure. And I have felt so welcomed. And if you haven't had a chance yet, if we haven't had the opportunity to meet, I'm looking forward to that. And maybe you've had a chance to read some of the material that the PNC sent out about my journey to seminary and the work that I did before. I loved my work very much. I spent a lot of years honing my skills, not only in simplification, but management and as a presenter, working with budgets, deliverables, schedules. When I finally allowed myself to heed God's call to ministry, it was partly because I finally felt like I might have something to offer. I knew things that might be valuable. And in seminary, I learned more skills, Hebrew and Greek, though full disclosure, not to any kind of scholarly level. I learned liturgy and preaching and sacraments, all the things that you need to know to serve a church. Just to save God the trouble, I was also very clear about how I would fit into the church. Slipping into the middle of a large ministry team in a church that resembled something like the corporate world that I had come from. I had it all figured out. And then God called me to Queens. First Sunday, I went out to the church in Astoria. I remember I just had to laugh at God's sense of humor. It was nothing like what I had thought I was getting into, but the spirit in that place was so strong. And I just knew that God had something else in mind. Then after just a few days after my ordination there as transitional pastor, a woman in the congregation that I had gotten to know came to me with very sad news that her son had suffered from a fall. Their story is not my story to share, but I can tell you that in that moment and in those conversations, I realized that it was not my expertise that God had called me into ministry to bring. It was my brokenness. It was the places that made me the most vulnerable, the things that I counted as failures, as things to do ministry in spite of. These were actually the things that God was calling me to bring. When I read Simon's words, "Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man," they cut right to my heart. Sinful is one of those words that we've loaded up also with a lot of church meaning. In the Greek, it means missing the mark, falling short. I can relate to what Simon must have experienced when Jesus filled his nets to overflowing, when he was sure he was just humoring this man who had healed his mother. He was sure that he knew what to expect when he lowered those nets again. He had fished there all night, and he already knew, but he had it wrong, and I had it wrong. Now, I'm a Presbyterian, and so I am not trying to say that I don't value expertise. I do. I value learning and knowledge and practical skill. At the same time, I've learned that I have to examine what I consider to be expertise carefully, time and again, as I discern how God can use me. In learning about your history here at Second Presbyterian Church, I became fascinated by the story of Catherine Williams Ferguson and her Sunday school. I'm sure most of you know it very well, but in a nutshell, for those who may not, Catherine Williams was born into slavery and later was a part of creating a Sunday school for working children of the time that was housed in the church that preceded this one, your church. And one part of her story that caught my attention as I prepared for this morning was the part where some of her students couldn't believe it when they learned that their teacher had never learned to read. How could she have corrected them so precisely, word for word, in a catechism that she had never read? How was it possible? The unimaginable was possible because Katie made room for God. Katie knew that what she didn't know, God's presence would be sufficient to provide. In this way, in the deep water of racism, poverty, and grief, Katie put out again and again at Jesus' calling. She changed countless lives because, like Simon, she was willing to make room in her boat for God. Reading Katie's story in the context of Black History Month, which started this week, I had to wonder how Katie Williams Ferguson might be counted out as a teacher today because of systems and structures that are so sure that they know what expertise is needed. I'm reminded that much of what we have counted, what I have counted as expertise in my lifetime, is hopelessly entwined with racism and steeped in whiteness. For this reason alone, it's important to carefully examine what we count as expertise, especially when it is not what God needs to bring a life-giving presence. Our faith calls us time and again into deep waters. No matter if we're sure that we already know the outcome, no matter if we are the experts, and God will surely use the skills that we bring to navigate those waters. After all, it was Simon who had the boat and knew how to steer it. Jesus used Simon's expertise, no doubt. He also called on Simon to set aside his expertise and make space for the work that God was doing, that only God could do. When it comes to our expertise, God calls us to be ready to use it and to be ready to set it aside, to stay open to what God is doing. The Buddhists call it beginner's mind, willingness to be open to not knowing, to letting go. That's what it will take for Simon and James and John to follow Jesus. Letting go of what they thought they knew about partnerships and contracts and deadlines and quotas and failure and success. Leaving it all behind, because instead of seeing what they already knew, they saw what God makes possible. One last thing about this story, going back to the way that the church has been so sure that we know what Jesus is asking of the disciples, of us, to reel people in through the church doors. That interpretation has set us up to feel that we're always falling short. And frankly, I think it may have distracted us from what Jesus is really calling us to. The power in this story isn't in the capturing. It's in the letting go. It was Simon's recognition of how small his calculations had been and how much greater God's power was than the powers that he had been serving. When Jesus calls Simon and James and John and you and me to catch people, he knows that life experience has given them much and prepared them for the way ahead. It's just not what they thought was important. What Jesus sees is their patience, their persistence, their steadfastness, their connectedness as community, their connectedness to nature, and in this moment, their willingness to leave behind what they know So let's try. Let's try to open our minds about what Jesus means by catching people. Maybe catching people means catching someone's eye, making that connection that lets them know that they are seen and known. Maybe it means catching the joy that someone is experiencing and sharing it with them. Maybe it means catching someone as she's falling. Maybe it means catching someone's attention by letting go of what you know and making space for what God is doing. In this deep water that we're called to, time and time and time again, it's God's presence with us that makes it possible to make room for the unimaginable. It's letting go and leaving behind what we are so sure we already know that catches us up and carries us where God is leading. I want to share, by way of closing, a brief section of a poem by Amanda Gorman called What We Carry. In discarding almost everything, our rage, our wreckage, our hubris, our hate, our ghosts, our greed, our wrath, our wars on the beating shore, we haven't any haven for them here. Rejoice, for what we have left behind will not free us. But what we have left is all we need. We are enough, armed only with our hands, open but unemptied. Just like a blooming thing, we walk into tomorrow, carrying nothing but the world. Amen.